For your final helping of oysters, clams, and katanas, presented by Bolin Media. I am Ross Bolin Sama, here today with Barrett Dudley Sama to digest and discuss the 10th and final episode of Shogun from Hulu/FX, titled A Dream of a Dream. It's like Inception, Barrett.
A dream within a dream.
There are levels to this shit.
There are,
you know?
Levels. Yeah.
Who
else said a dream within a dream? Isn't that like some Mary Poppins stuff or something?
I don't know.
I feel like it's a poem.
Who does a song about dreams?
Is it a Robert Frost poem?
Is it in Les Miserables? Cats? No, that's Memories.
In Les Mis, there is a dream. Yes.
There is a dream.
She sings of her dream.
Okay, the Les Mis. I think that's what I'm thinking about. Shouts to Anne Hathaway.
Yeah, Anne Hathaway to Frost.
She sings that song in the.
She was a hooah.
Rosser, just to start things off, are you disappointed that we did not get the second and only the second appearance of Mariko's son? It would have been the second time that he showed up in the show.
Yeah, it's just insane.
If they put him in the finale, it would have been the second time.
I thought
maybe we'd see him again for
the
second
time. They introduced that character in episode 9
right,
for the first time.
For the first time.
And then you expect that maybe he'll play a role in episode 10. We're trolling all of you as hard as we possibly can at this point. But I will note on a similar vein, I cannot freaking believe that once again I jumped in on a theory and I was like, the heir is Toranaga's son. And it never came to fruition, not even close to fruition.
Yeah.
And I told myself I was done theorizing after True Detective season 4. Mm-hmm. And I just can't stop. And I can't stop being wrong.
We talked on Patreon about it. I guess this is the first time back.
Yes,
for just our regular listeners that are not supporting the podcast.
Sad, very unfair.
I really stepped in it, Ross. Boy, I really stepped
in. And then I jumped in with you.
And you jumped in with me. I dragged you down. I dragged you right down the hole.
We're still getting comments from people on YouTube,
yeah.
Man.
People are mad. People are mad. This one guy on Twitter said that we weren't qualified to talk about the show on a podcast.
I saw one dude who was like, I've been riding with y'all since, 2016. And this is the first episode I've ever heard where your analysis was like not up to snuff.
And
mentioned the Mariko son thing. And I was just like, Jesus, were we that bad?
So
hopefully we're better today.
So. And I'll take it. I'll take that one. I did. It's definitely on me for failing to remember that Mariko's son is in 2 earlier episodes, or at least 2 scenes.
Two separate
scenes in earlier episodes. I don't remember if it
was
the same episode or not.
Yeah.
But I was the one that had the big analysis about that scene and said that they should have tossed it. And look, now I'm also going to stand my ground. That scene still didn't work for me. And in fact, I'm just going to deflect the blame and say that it's just an indictment of those earlier scenes and kind of how inconsequential they were that I didn't even remember this kid.
Yeah,
you also mentioned that he may have gone through puberty.
He seemed like it.
There's some weird production stuff with this show, like how they had to get a set up, and they had to get Toranaga, the guy that plays Toranaga, out on. They had to film some stuff in like 2018 to keep the rights to the show. You know, sometimes that happens
where
it's like your deal is like if you haven't started shooting by X date, it's like the rights lapse and we can resell them to somebody else.
Yes.
So I don't know how long production was or how many different kind of years of shooting.
Well, they did say they worked on this for a very, very long time. I want to say they said like a decade.
But I'm with you that like because I think I went back and I saw some still frames from those earlier scenes with the son, and it's the same guy, but he looks like a little kid compared to his appearance in episode 9.
In the old penultimate,
yeah. My point being, that I still maintain that what those earlier scenes did do for us was kind of illuminate that Buntaro was this really brusque, harsh, not that great of a father figure.
Kind of a prick.
Kind of a prick. And that was my takeaway. And I wasn't really, it's not like Mariko was like doing a whole bunch of mothering or anything.
Right.
And so when he pops up 6 hours later, and it's supposed to be this big deal, that just didn't hit hard for me. And yeah. So that's still how I feel about that. And after the final episode, I still feel okay about my overall take, because it wasn't a relationship that that the show cared about a ton in the end, especially when it comes to Mariko.
I think my current stance is that you and I not being mothers, it doesn't hit the same.
Maybe so. Maybe
so for so. I think for mothers, that scene is probably hitting a lot differently.
Yeah.
But anyway, let's jump to today's episode.
Yes, yes, yes.
I want us to discuss the episode in full and share our thoughts on the finale, and then we can grade the season on the whole at the end of today's show.
Okay.
Cool?
Yeah.
So let's dive into the finale, and I'm going to be bouncing around a little bit more than usual to make sense of all this, all right? Maybe a little bit more out of order than the Clam fam is used to, but I will start at the start. So at the beginning of the finale, we see an elderly Blackthorn on his deathbed, clutching Todomariko's rosary with these two little white kids that are like they're trying to get his sword off the wall, right?
Yeah, they're like, "Oh, at a samurai sword,
Grandpa's samurai sword. He killed a whole bunch of savages with it." And yeah, so what? I mean, having seen the entire finale, like, what was your read on the whole flash forward to on his deathbed, Blackthorn?
It
took me a minute to realize it was him, by the way.
I thought it was a woman. No, seriously, first 30 seconds, I was like, who is this old woman?
It was his eyes that gave it away for me, though. Yeah, I was like, oh, that's his crazy ass.
His crystal blue piercing eyes.
Yeah.
It was interesting. I think this scene doesn't really hit for you until Torunaga says about 40 minutes into the episode that he doesn't believe it's Blackthorn's fate to ever leave Japan.
Right.
And so when he says that, it's like immediate flag. Well, we know he does. We know that he does leave. He does go return home.
But Barrett, he does not.
No?
That is a dream of a dream.
That's the dream of a dream.
The confirmation that Blackthorn never leaves Japan is when he and Fuji go out onto the water for their little funeral procession.
And he drops
Mariko's rosary into the water.
Yeah.
Okay. So the flash forward of him clutching the rosary cannot be real, because that thing is at the bottom of Izu Lake, I'll call it, even though that's definitely not what it's called.
I was going to get to this, is that I also don't understand how he has the rosary when we watch him drop it into the lake.
So that whole thing was like his imagination of what his life could be if he returned to England. Because not only does he have like the two little white kids, right?
Yep.
Which are his grandchildren.
Yep.
But that place he is in, that room, I mean, it's like he became wealthy,
right?
Like, it's really nice.
Yeah.
I mean, it was a curious beginning to the episode, and it was very confusing, and
that's not something that I caught.
Yeah, a lot of people walked away confused about that whole thing, but the rosary was the nail in the coffin for anybody who thought Blackthorn might leave Japan. He definitely spends the rest of his life there, in my opinion.
The one thing that was noticeable throughout this season, but I really was picking up on in the finale, is how dreamlike a lot of this series was shot. There's pretty much a black vignette on almost every scene.
Yeah.
Which makes it, that evokes a lot of different things, but it does make you feel kind of, it gives you like that like kind of tunnel vision dream state, kind of feel. And so that's interesting that they've kind of shot a lot of this in a dreamlike state, and then that scene also had a big vignette on it.
And the finale title, "A Dream of a Dream,"
"A Dream of a Dream." That's really interesting, and I'm glad that you picked up on that, because I had not tied that into the episode title.
Yeah, it kind of shook me as the opening, because I was like, "Damn, are we gonna like at that point?" you know, in the headspace I was in, I was like, okay, so we're going to have like a big battle this episode, huge battle, massive showdown, war is coming, and then we're going to see like where Blackthorn ends up in old age later on. This is going to be tight. But then, yeah, eventually, as things unfolded, I was like, oh, shit, this is...
It's not what they're doing.
It's getting artsy here, which we kind of did throughout the entire episode. Yeah, we open with that. Then in Osaka, we see Ishido meet with the Council of Regents, and these people are now very displeased with him, albeit they're expressing that in a very cordial way. And they say, like, we don't feel like we're as safe here in Osaka as we once did as a result of Todomoriko's death, right? You got to remember, although Ishido points out, like, she's from the Akechin family or whatever, we don't respect these people, they... you know, killed the Taiko or whatever. She's still very well respected by everybody else. Her family is still very well respected by everybody else, and they're not cool with the fact that she just got offed.
Yeah, and this is where we have we have a few questions answered in this scene, right? It's like, okay, so what was the point of having the shinobi rush in and do this bum rush and try to grab Mariko? Here it is. Ishido is going to try to blame this on Torinaga.
Right.
Hide her away and then say that this covert attack was all part of Torinaga's plan.
And that Torinaga smuggled her out.
Yes. Not tied to him, etc.
Which he still tries to pull off. He's like, only Torinaga would be cunning and conniving enough to hatch such a plan.
Yep.
And you could tell nobody buys that.
Crimson Sky, Crimson Sky turned out to be the podcast that we made along the way, but also Crimson Sky was this mission for Mariko. And we had this discussion last week, right? We said that like she seems relieved when she doesn't have to go the seppuku route.
To do the coup.
But then when this opportunity presents itself for her to become the martyr and kind of fulfill the mission, she grabs it.
Right.
And that was the point. I think we lay that out pretty nicely because Torinaga needed Mariko to go.
Yeah.
He needed her to be the sacrifice to die like this so that there was a turn on Ishido.
Yeah, back to the whole hawk thing, right? You release the hawk, you trust the hawk to figure out, you know, its plan of attack or whatever. I think he didn't necessarily know exactly how Todomoriko would come to die in Osaka, but he had told her like you need to figure a way.
Yep.
And make it worth it, it work, right? I was still a little confused by the shinobi blowing the door open and then not running in. And, like, I guess they blew the door open and they were like, oh, shit, she's dead. And then they just ninja'd their way out.
Yeah, probably.
Like, just bounced. Yeah, but, anyway, at that Council of Regents meeting, Lady Ochiba is pretty clearly out on Ishido. Like, she doesn't say that, but she's, you know, putting out the vibe that this guy... probably not going to get her backing longer term. And again, Ishido doesn't realize any of this because I just don't think he was a very smart dude. He thought he was a lot smarter than he was, right?
Yeah.
So after Todomoriko's death, which is confirmed, they give us a body at the beginning of the episode. I have no choice but to accept it. Blackthorn is smuggled out of Osaka. And it turns out Todomoriko made a deal with Father Alvito to spare the Anjin's life in exchange for his ship being sunk, which was... just a confusing, like, when they're walking through the woods and he stops and he's looking around, I was like, he's taking one last chance to, like, soak in Osaka. And then the scene kept going, and I was like, or he thinks he's about to be murdered. Is he about to be murdered? And then he says he thinks he's about to be murdered. And Alvito's like, you were about to be murdered. But then things changed. Yeah. And, that whole, you know, Alvito gives us a better explanation as we go on. But it was like, at first, I was just like, what is happening? What is this? Why are they letting him leave?
Here in the early stages of this kind of unfolding, you get the gist that Mariko essentially like made a deal to save him,
right?
But you don't actually know why or what the trade off was or how Kiyama's men would kind of like, you're kind of wondering like what type of deal would they have made,
right?
You know, they wanted nothing more than for this heretic to be
killed.
To be killed.
No, and I'm still pretty confused about the ins and outs of the deal, to be honest, because the only thing I can guess is that the Catholics were like, sure, okay, fine. We release him, but we get to sink his ship.
Yeah, which saves the threat of him coming after the black ship.
Right.
Yeah.
So that's it? That's
yep.
That was the trade. It still feels a little funky. Why not just kill him and sink the black ship? You know what I mean? Like, but I get it. I get it. There's like an honor code and whatnot.
And there's a mention later that Mariko is negotiating on behalf of the church.
Right.
Right. So I think that it's like her tie to Alvito. And then I think this also harkens back to some of the inroads that Alvito had made with Toranaga about kind of coming around to his side a little bit.
Yeah.
Like there were just inroads were made. Bridges were built. And I think they were able to come to this agreement that, like, we'll give you the Anjin back, but you got to take out his ship.
So that he
can't come fuck with us.
In our trade routes, yeah. On that note, Rodriguez, and really the Portuguese on the whole, never came back into play.
Not really, yeah.
Which bummed me out, and I'll just say is one of the reasons, among some of the other things we just discussed, they certainly could have stretched this into two seasons.
Uh-huh.
Like, they had the characters, they had the story to give us more of a more fleshed out version if they wanted to.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not saying I don't appreciate the season they put together, and I'll give my thoughts on the whole season at the end of the show today, but certainly they could have, because like Rodriguez not coming back, I was very surprised by that.
That didn't surprise me. I felt like his story was wrapped up pretty well in whatever his last episode was. He felt like kind of just like a bit player, you know, like he was there to kind of like establish a little bit of a rapport with Blackthorn, kind of introduce him to some the way of things, the landscape, what the Portuguese were doing, how they tied to the Japanese. They save each other's lives, and then it was like, all right, this guy's out of here.
Yeah.
But the fact that I was, you know, vocal about kind of expecting like another shoe to drop when it came to the whole black ship Portuguese negotiation things, and I guess it sort of does
with the sinking of
it plays
Erasmus
in here, and they save him, they save his life in a way, but overall definitely less of a deal than I thought it would be after the first four episodes or so.
So Blackthorn is transported back to Edo, or not Edo, is it Edo? Izu,
yeah, back to Izu, yeah.
And that's when he sees his, you know, his ship has been sunk.
With Big Yops. It's him and Big Yops.
Big Yops, who is losing his fucking mind.
Yeah, and it Ishido's like, go back to Izu, get your army.
Get your army.
Yeah.
And we're going to war. Yeah, tells Yabushige that. Blackthorn is told that Christian spies sunk his ship on the church's behalf before he, you know, finds out the more thorough truth later on. And as a result of the ship being sunk, Toranaga is beheading people in the village and putting their heads on spikes, and he's trying to root out the traitors and the vibes back in that fishing village are bad.
He's not going to sleep until he figures out who did this.
Right.
Who could have done this?
We're all looking for
the guy who did this.
Yeah. I'm glad we finally got a I think you should leave joke in here. Okay, so Fuji tells Blackthorn she is no longer his consort, that she has received permission from Toranaga to go and become a nun, and at first Blackthorn protests, but then he's like, Fuji-sama, best nun. it was interesting in this episode watching him try to communicate with everybody without his translator, Mariko.
It's
one of the ways
you
feel her absence.
I thought that him having to go with his limited Japanese, both listening and speaking, was a nice wrinkle to the finale here. And not that far-fetched. He's been there 6, 8, 10 months, something like that. And it's like, that's how you learn a language, is when you have no other choice.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, it's that full immersion type of stuff. So, it's also starting to paint the picture of this dude more and more and more and more belonging here.
Right. So, eventually Blackthorn gets in front of Toranaga. He's extremely upset with how Toranaga is treating the village, that he's, you know, beheading people and running riot, trying to figure out who sunk this ship, the Erasmus, his ship. And Blackthorn is like, my takeaway from this scene was essentially that now that Mariko has died, he has kind of finally completely bought into the Japanese way of life and to their culture. And he says, fuck it, you know, I'm not bigger than this whole village.
Mm-hmm.
I'll kill myself. It's me. I was the bad guy. I'm your enemy. He's yelling it at him. He's extremely animated. He's going to give his own life in exchange for the villagers' safety, and he's going to commit the coup. And that's it. That Toranaga has to like step in and stop him when he's about to gut himself, which I had to have known.
Yeah. Really interesting stuff here when Blackthorne is kind of saying it all out loud, right?
That right.
He was the enemy. He's the enemy. He was using Toranaga. You know, kind of makes you think about the earlier, the big scene that closes out episode two, right? When he's like drawing in the sand and he's explaining everything that the Portuguese want to do.
Right.
Was that all, you know, was that a bunch of bullshit that he was feeding to Toranaga to try to get to his own kind of agenda? Or
yeah, I think it was a callback to the fact that he wanted Toranaga to team up with him and go after the Portuguese. That's yeah. all he ever wanted. It was yeah. never about anything else for him. Like, and he's trying to
that everything that he was saying, pitching out to Toranaga as potentially good for him, was that part was kind of a bunch of like he didn't really care about that. He just wanted to get after the Portuguese.
He wanted his way.
He yeah, wanted his way.
That was all just his sales pitch, right?
Yep.
But yeah, so Toranaga steps in, stops him from committing seppuku, and tells him in very like Toranaga fashion, you know, because there's not a lot of niceties.
Yeah.
He's just like, nope, stop, can't do that. Go get your ship, rebuild it, and then make me a fleet. And at that point, I was like, yes, we're going to get a fleet. We're going to war. We're going to have a big battle. Of course, that doesn't end up happening, but yeah. So
no, I think it was about at this point in the episode when, and like you said, we've kind of jumped around a little bit to get to this scene, but I want to say this was at about 30, 35 minutes. And this is happening, and he talks about the ship and says, like, now build me a fleet. And I paused, and I was like, okay, how much time left do we have in this episode?
Yeah.
Because fleet building, look, I've never built a boat before, but I'm pretty sure that's going to take a lot of time. A lot of time. So
I kept telling myself there could be a time jump.
How much of this episode do we have left? And it was like 22 minutes, and I was like, okay. So it was right about here, I think, that I kind of understood what this episode was doing and where it was not going, which was to any type of climactic battle scene.
Right.
To any type of confrontation. And in doing that, I'll save kind of my overall thoughts for the end of the episode, but this was very bold choice. I thought this was a super bold choice because it really, really subverted, I think, expectations that everybody, maybe outside of book readers, had for this finale. And it really, like, in the end, it really did penultimate us, you know? It did the big thing where the ninth episode or the second to last episode is really the big one where the you know,
the
big events go down. And then the finale is really closure. It's really wrapping up the story and kind of putting bows on character arcs. So that was all, this was, it, you know, it's not what I expected. And so there is a piece of me that kind of like, was like, ah, no battle.
Right.
But at the same time, I thought it was a really, really interesting choice. And it was about at this moment where I was like, I think I see what they're doing.
Yeah. Yeah. Also up there during this whole dramatic Blackthorne's attempted seppuku scene, Toranaga allows Miragi to reveal his true samurai identity to Blackthorne. It's not that it wasn't a cool scene. It was. I just didn't think it hit as hard as maybe it should have or that they thought it would, perhaps. Like, Blackthorne gives this reaction like, oh, my God. You know, I guess it just like further reveals to Blackthorne that Toranaga still is that master manipulator and schemer. Which he was billed as, that Blackthorne had kind of lost faith in. But in the moment,
well, I do agree with you because at first Miragi is like, this is too much for a simple fisherman to do.
Right.
And I was like, what are you talking about? You got to reveal that you're a samurai to be allowed to like translate. I don't know. I guess it was like, there's no way a commoner peasant would be so fluent in both languages, something like that. So if he's going to go to the full translation, start speaking both languages, he's got to say who he really is.
I took it as Miragi was just like, I've been doing all this fucking undercover work, man. I just want one person to know how badass I am. Just one person to know.
But I kind of had a similar feeling where I was like, okay, is this a giant reveal for Blackthorne who, like, I don't know, he's not like... It's not like you become besties with Miragi as just a humble commoner, villager, fisherman.
Right. They hadn't spent a ton of time hanging out. Like, that would have made it hit a little different, right? Like, that's, yeah.
But
still a cool scene.
It is a cool scene.
Oh, also, back in Osaka, before they headed over here, I forgot. I just wanted to make sure we talk about this. When Ishido comes out and finds Big Yobbs in the garden, losing his mind.
Oh, yeah, he's really, really going through it.
Just riddled with guilt, and yeah. he hallucinates the earthquake-causing catfish in the pond. And Ishido is like, Yobbs, there are no catfish in the pond. And he's like, oh. And then literally 5 seconds later, he's back to trying to get a catfish out of the pond.
Yeah.
I've seen this multiple places being called like Yabushige's Lady Macbeth moment. I guess Lady Macbeth is driven mad by guilt that like haunts her for the rest of her life, follows her for the rest of her days or whatever. Which, that does really make sense for Yabushige when you see like he's going crazy there in the garden, in that pond. He's going crazy on the ship when he's like, let's fucking do diving diving like you did with Torunaga. And Blackthorn has to be like, pull yourself together, man.
I think he mentions with Ishido too, right, that like
he didn't know they were
going to kill Mariko.
Right. And Ishido's like, hey, neither did I.
Yeah, yeah.
Neither did I, which is the genius of Mariko's execution there, is that she is the one who chose to die because she knew she needed to, because she saw what they were trying to do, which was going to be to take her captive and blame it all on Torunaga.
Yep.
But Yabushige is being crushed by the guilt of this thing. Yep. And then when you finally get the scene where Torunaga's telling him, like, you're done here, it's almost relief to him, I think, because he's like, okay, I don't have to carry this for, like, another 30 years or whatever.
And are you talking about the hill scene or, like, when they first get off the boat
and he's brought before Torunaga, back where Blackthorn was brought before Torunaga in episode 2 or 1 or whatever it was. It just made it, because he kind of, it was almost like Yabushige snapped out of the insanity in that scene. Like he was like, back to his big
Yobbs. Has to admit that he did participate in the betrayal.
That he was the Judas.
Yeah.
Did watching this show make you wish you had the mental clarity, focus, and creativity of a samurai lord like Torunaga? Today's episode is brought to you by Schedule 35, the most trusted psilocybin consumer brand in North America. So listen up. Not all drugs are created equal. Psilocybin, for example, when taken thoughtfully at sub-hallucinogenic levels, can sharpen your focus, hone your mental clarity, unleash your creativity, expand your mind, open your heart, and ease your anxiety. While you shouldn't experiment with those shrooms you got from your brother's sketchy friend, Schedule 35 takes a science-backed approach to microdosing shrooms. They precisely measure out every dose, they verify the age of every one of their customers, they ship discreetly, and they give you a microdosing regimen that allows you to enjoy the benefits of psilocybin without any of the hallucinogenic effects. Research around psilocybin has proven to help with mental health, PTSD, anxiety, focus, and depression. Studies have shown that psilocybin works by creating new neural networks in the brain, which can help boost focus, creativity, mood enhancement, and can even help fight addiction. All Schedule 35 products come with guides that make microdosing easy to understand. They're super thorough, so there's no confusion, and you know exactly what you're taking, how much to take, and when to take it. Here at Bolin Media, we're always looking to improve our mental health, and myself and our producer, actually, have personally enjoyed Schedule 35's microdosing plans and been extremely impressed by the results. Schedule 35 ships all across Canada and the U.S. and is the most notable brand currently in the space. All customers will need to be age-verified, 19-plus in Canada, 21-plus in the U.S., and again, Schedule 35 is all about accurate doses, discreet shipping, and can be beneficial for those who do or don't suffer from any mental health issues. Get 15% off with code OCC at schedule35.co. That's 15% off at schedule35.co when you use code OCC. So back in Ishido. Yabushige is brought before Torunaga, who knows it was Yabushige who admitted the shinobi into Osaka because...
I know it was you.
This was so confusing. So Omi, Yabushige's nephew, informed Torunaga of Yabushige's betrayal after Omi received word from one of Mariko's ladies-in-waiting who saw Yabushige begging for forgiveness to himself.
Yeah, which we see.
Yeah, they do give us that
he
scene.
He goes like, forgive me, or something like that. He's clearly like, oh shit. Like,
and that was enough. Lady saw that and was like I must send word to Omi.
Yes, yeah.
That his uncle has betrayed Torunaga.
Yeah.
So Yabushige pleads for a good death. He wants to be torn apart by dogs or eaten alive by piranhas. He just like throws a couple of his random ideas
out. There was no coming back from what Big Yobbs did, even though they strung me along. I thought there was a chance through, and basically until
Until it happens.
Until it happens. You're like...
Like, literally up until the moment that Torinaga takes out the sword, and even then, I was
even then you're like,
he's gonna knight him with it. I didn't want him to die.
I know. And this is... And I think they almost, like, bring you back, or bring him back to your side a little bit, the audience's side, because he's the only one that seems to have, like, this modern approach to death, which is like, nah, I don't want to die. I don't want
to
kill myself.
I'm going to try to avoid this.
I do not want to plunge a dagger into my belly.
Right.
And then have my head whacked off. Like, that does not sound like a good way to go.
And that if he has to die, he wants to choose the way he's going to die. Like, it takes you back to that original scene where Blackthorn saves his life because Yabushige is about to drown. Or I guess Blackthorn doesn't save his life.
Blackthorn, he kind of
does. He kind of saves his life. Yeah, he gets them to go and look for him, right?
He's willing to do the coup there, so that, you know, that...
But that's... because he thinks he's about to die anyway.
Right.
So
right.
As long as he gets to control his death, he's...
Yeah.
The point being, the man has some very Western issues with death.
It seems like it. He has the most Western version of how he kind of perceives and approaches it. And so I think that's... I think that's intentional. You know what I mean? That everybody else is just so willing, so seemingly not scared, not fearful of death.
Right.
That it's almost refreshing to get a guy that's like, yeah, I don't want to do that.
Yeah. I'm still sitting here trying to make sense of, like, the whole back and forth with him and Torinaga, though, because he's like, give me a good death. Let me, you know, put me in the piranha pond or boil me alive. You know, let's pick one of the cool options that I've studied over the years.
Yeah, that he pick one from my list.
And Torinaga,
you know,
says,
top 10 on my list. Give me one of those.
Torinaga's reasoning for making him do the coup is, no, I don't trust you, which I didn't really register all the way for me. It's like, so you don't think he'll actually go through with it, I guess, is maybe what he meant. But that was strange to me because it was basically like, no, you don't get to pick.
Yeah, right.
It's seppuku for you or nothing, you know? So it was like, that was a little odd. But Yabushige is like, fine, I want Blackthorn as my second. And Torinaga's like, no. And then he's like, well, fine, you be my second. Torinaga's like, all right, I can do that.
Okay.
Yeah,
okay.
I was looking forward to this scene that we're going to have together on the cliffside. So yes, I will be your second. And that was my favorite part of the finale. Was the conversation between Big Yabs, Yabushige, and Torinaga on the cliffside before the final committing of the coup of this season.
Yeah.
Where Torinaga, he reveals some of his scheming to Yabushige.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I still don't have, like, I won't lie to you, I still don't have a full, clear picture of exactly how all of Torinaga's scheming and planning came to fruition. But he does give us some things, like he confirms the Crimson Sky was actually Mariko going to Osaka to change Lady Ochiba's mind about her alliance with Ishido.
Yeah.
That was the whole plan.
Let's lay it all out, Ross.
Wow. It's even folded up. Baird is unfolding a piece of paper that is folded just like the messages in the show.
Okay, so let's see how it went down.
Okay. How do you even have... I love how they unfold it as they're reading.
Yeah, uh-huh. And then it's like 27 folds in there.
Yeah, that one was comically long.
It's a CVS receipt, basically.
Yeah, seriously.
Okay, so Mariko goes and does her thing.
Barrett brought props. Really taking the finale seriously.
And she's got the private moment with Lady Ochiba, who's clearly very affected by what she says, the beliefs that she espouses, the commitment to her liege lord, all of that.
They were sisters.
She's doing, you know, the good. She's giving her that good on the poetry front.
Yep.
And then I think when she dies in the attack, that is like the final straw for Lady Ochiba, who that's enough for her to shift alliances. Right.
Yeah, but it just, my problem with it is that Torinaga would need to, I mean, he would have to know, like, all right, well, if Mariko goes up there and dies, that'll be the straw that breaks the camel's back, and Ochiba will flip to my side, right?
Yeah.
It just seemed like such a big risk, and in the scene where he does the paper unfolding like you just did, you do see this like, hint of a smile, like, one side of his mouth, like, I can't really do it, but... That Torinaga is like, oh, thank God, it worked almost. Yeah, you know what? That's his version of it. Like, okay, we did it. But in that moment, I was like, man, so many big risks here.
All right. I think maybe what happens a little bit also, Think about that scene with the regents, right? Lady Ochibia is kind of like sitting behind Ishido a little bit.
Right.
She's still letting him run the show, but in that way, she gets to be very observational, for almost get a bird's eye view of the whole scene.
Sure.
And I think that...
And almost stay not all the way in,
all the, right?
Right.
Yeah. Yes, totally. And I think what Torunaga is counting on is that what she wants is a seat of power of some sort. And I think she's watching these guys, like the earthquake happens, and they're all like, ooh, maybe we should rethink this.
Like, that's an omen.
That's an omen, right?
We find out that happened at some point in the past and was some big historical deal, yeah.
Yeah, so I think what she's seeing is the tides turning against Ishido, and she wants to be on the winning side.
Yeah.
And the faith is that this Mariko death is going to enrage all of the families and all of the noble people and all of the people that have been trapped at Osaka.
And it's proven that they're hostages.
That there's already discord between the regents, that they're already kind of getting sick of Ishido's game.
Right.
And that the whole thing is just going to, like, it's just going to neuter any power that Ishido had left. And that she basically won't have a choice but to align with Torunaga if she wants to stay towards the top.
Well, and her whole thing is about keeping her son safe, right? And like, Torunaga's going to do that. So I think that played a part in it as well. But it was just, it was interesting to hear Torunaga delivering these lines to Yabushige when I know that a lot of the audience, we get it on a basic level. Like, okay, so his plan did work, but the actual machinations of it
and I'm,
are still confusing.
And I'm just trying to fill in the gaps because you're not wrong. Like, and what Torunaga says when he's kind of, you know, giving the exposition up there is that his army would surely fall against a united regent front.
Yeah. Says, I sent a woman to accomplish what no army could.
Yeah.
Right?
But then with this, he delivers this letter and that says that Lady Ochiba is not bringing her banners. And then all of the other armies will turn on him, basically. They won't even have to lift a sword.
Right.
So to that end, he is counting on Lady Ochiba coming over to his side, not bringing her banners. And if she doesn't, then he still does seem kind of screwed.
Yeah.
So I'm with you.
But it did work.
That this is, I don't have an exact like causation of exactly why he knew this would work.
How he knew that it would work.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So that's the thing. I've seen it presented as like the Dumbledore problem. And we even had a comparison, like earlier in the season, we kind of compared the two. But that Dumbledore, in the end, it felt like all this crazy, you know, planning and all these different events that had to occur and all these terrible, dangerous things that had to happen. And he knew the whole time that it, like, so confidently that it would work out the way he thought it would. And that's like how it was with Torunaga. It was like, no matter what, he knew that they would end up here on this cliffside. Like, he'd be telling Big Yobs before the seppuku. Like, it's like he was omniscient.
Yep.
Which was hard to really make peace with, I think.
I think the Dumbledore comparison is a good one because it's like, this kind of is an issue when you're telling a story like this and you create a character that is such a masterful schemer that you run into these points where you just are like, you kind of just have to be like, the write off is basically like, well, he's just that good. He just knew.
Yeah.
He knew it would work. And I don't know how to explain that. Like,
which it's fine, but it's not as much fun as having like a concrete reason to believe. And, you know, they did give us enough, I think, of Torunaga's reputation to kind of solidify this whole thing. But I still felt it was lacking in some ways for me personally. It didn't affect the overall quality of the show necessarily. It was just like, especially in this moment on the cliffside with Yabushige, I was just like, oh, damn, you risked a lot here.
Yeah, yeah. And I mean, I also thought this scene was very cool. I liked the conversation between Yabs and Torunaga here. It was all very evocative and sad. Somehow they still made you feel for Yabs up there. And Torunaga kind of really kind of comes together as like a benevolent big bad, almost, if you will. Like, he was going for Shogun the whole time. But I'll nitpick this scene a little bit further because it's not my favorite way for a show to end when they have to do a scene that's basically just exposition to tell you what happened. And that's what happens in this scene, regardless of the machinations behind it all or why he knew it would work. We have to get to this scene with 10 minutes left so that Torunaga can stand up on a cliff and deliver a monologue that tells us what happened.
Yeah, but at least the setup was
going to happen.
At least the setup was a man who's about to die. Begging for knowledge.
For shows that need to go this route, when you get to this point and you're like, okay, we don't have any choice but to have a scene where somebody explains what the hell just happened or what is going to happen or whatever. They pulled it off in a really good way. I will give them that this was a nice, this was a good setup for an expository scene. And I liked it. I'm with you on that. But at the same time, it doesn't change the facts that they didn't get to show us this. They had to tell us.
Which again, I would argue is because they only had one season here. And that made it really tough. And also, just to give credit where it's due, Tadanobu Asano, the guy who played Yabushige, unfucking believable performance. My favorite character in the show. Through every single episode, that guy was awesome. And I really appreciated him and what he brought to
the
thing.
I mean, we should just say all the actors' names. Anna Sawai, playing Mariko, really kind of a breakout turn for her. She was awesome.
Hiroyuki Sanada. Is Torunaga.
Yeah. And we know him from a bunch of other stuff. You've definitely seen him on screen before, but this was kind of the first time that he really got to like kind of carry a show and be a lead. And he pulled it off really, really well. So.
I really liked Cosmo Jarvis. Some people didn't. His character was a confusing one, which we can get to in a moment. But yeah, that's who played Anjin Sama. And also in this final, so like Yabushige, he kind of realizes that while all along Torunaga was claiming he wanted no more lands and no more power, that it seems he actually was planning this rise to shogun the entire time.
Yep.
And his quote that he throws at him is, "You're no better than the rest of us in your secret heart."
In your secret heart.
And I loved that moment just because, like you said, you spend the whole season being like, Torunaga's our good guy. That's our protagonist, and we should really be rooting for him because it's like morally sound. And he's like, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
But in the end, they kind of give you this scene with him and Yabushige that makes you realize like, oh, is he a good guy or
it's
just another power-hungry dude who's willing to sacrifice lives so he can get what he wants?
And it's a mixed bag,
right?
Because he does some pretty messed up stuff in this episode, like beheading a bunch of villagers and putting their heads on pikes
just to
make a test to Blackthorn.
Which I still don't understand what the test was. I still don't understand the test.
Basically to see if Blackthorn would do what he did. It's honestly, it's another kind of instance of like omniscience.
And
He knew that killing a bunch of villagers would potentially get Blackthorn to offer to commit the coup.
And it goes back to this belief that like no individual is important, that it's the bigger picture that matters.
Yep, yep.
But like I was sitting there thinking, God damn, I feel bad for these dudes who got their heads whacked off and stuck on these spikes and their families and their children when it was all just to see if Blackthorn would attempt to commit seppuku so that Torunaga could stop him and tell him to go build him a fleet of ships.
Now, at the same time, I called him like a benevolent big bad, which sort of is kind of how I felt about it. Like, yes, he was secretly gunning for maximum shogun power this entire time, but at the same time, the way he carries out his plan is that there is no war. He wins without a war.
Right.
Nobody lifts a sword. So that to that degree, he does seem to seek peace for Japan, which is what he talks about the whole season. It's like, what's good for Japan? What's good for Japan? Etc.
Yeah.
He's just this mastermind that pulls it off. But at the end, it's hard to say that he isn't also power hungry.
Extremely ironic that this is the analogy that popped into my head when watching this unfold and them showing us the scene where the, you know, battle doesn't occur. But it's like the atomic bomb thing.
Mm-hmm,
people have to die so that theoretically way more people don't have to die later.
Right.
And it did seem like that was supposed to feel like our payoff for Hiromatsu's death, for Mariko's death.
Yep.
When push comes to shove, this war is avoided entirely because Ishido is basically castrated. He has no more power. He has no banner out there. He does not receive the heir and Ochiba's backing.
Yep.
And bloodshed is avoided on a larger scale,
right,
which I did enjoy that payoff there. But damn, it took a lot to get to it.
This scene up on the hill, we both mentioned that, like, even as Torunaga unsheaths that sword, you're like, But maybe he's got like a secret mission for Yabushige that he's going to send him on.
Especially because he's basically straight up telling him, like, I used all y'all.
Yeah.
I knew what you would do.
I knew what you would do.
I sent you there. Yeah. It might as well have been me who made you betray me.
Yeah. Yes.
So
yes.
In my head, I'm like, well, then you could still save his life. You could still keep using him.
Yeah.
Why kill him? This is all your fucking fault. Yeah. You're admitting that it's all your fault, but then you're still whacking the man's head off. It was just that there was a lot, man.
It was a lot.
And that's where you get to the point where it's like Torinaga is not just the good guy.
He's not just a hero.
No. There's more to it than that, more depth to it than that, which is more realistic, right? Because that's often the case. Also, in this final conversation with Yabushige before his death, Torinaga tells him, like you said, Barrett, that he doesn't think Blackthorn will ever leave Japan, which was another hat tip to like that whole dream of a dream flash forward thing we got. Yabushige asks Torinaga, how does it feel to shape the wind to your will? Torinaga replies, I don't shape the wind, I only study it. That was over my head. And Yabushige...
He's kind of like saying it's not luck, it's preparation.
It's back to the hawk thing, too.
Yeah.
Right? You know your hawk well enough, and then you send your hawk off, and it'll do what it does.
Yeah. And really, I guess I should say, it's not a superpower. It's not a secret power that he has to shape the wind. He just is a student.
He spends the time.
Yeah. Puts in the work. Yeah, exactly.
Yabushige, like, begs Torinaga to tell him what comes next. He's like, I want to know, before I die, what's about to happen? What are you about to do? Right? And Torinaga's reply is, why tell a dead man the future? This was essentially Yabushige acting as an audience avatar, like, well, are you going to become shogun?
Right.
Like, are they going to crown your ass? What's going to happen here? What the fuck? But his reply is, why tell a dead man the future? And that really bummed me out, man. I get it. But at the same time, I was like, I don't need any more lessons right now. I need satisfaction as a television viewer. And I demand satisfaction. And he wouldn't give it to us. And that was more subverting the expectations of the audience. Most shows would give you that little cherry on top to make you feel good about everything you just watched. And Shogun was like, fuck you, Americans. We're not doing it that way.
A dream of a dream. Man, now I'm really invested in this title because a dream of a dream. Are they saying that this whole experience for Blackthorn was like a dream and then he is having a dream of a dream?
That's one read.
Or is it possible that the opening sequence is reality? And then the Japan stuff is the dream.
Big shoulder shrug.
Okay.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. I mean, partially, I think our takeaway is supposed to be that, like, the bomb blast knocks him unconscious, and he has this dream sequence situation of his life if he got back to England.
Yeah. Yeah.
But.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. That makes sense.
And that, yes, it's a dream of a dream. Because this whole situation with him in Japan has been dreamlike and weird.
Yeah.
And also, we get Yabushige's death poem.
It was all a dream.
Yep. It's so hard not to just do the rest of the song when you say that. But we don't have time for that. So Yabushige gives his death poem to Omi, which is, my dead body. Don't burn it. Don't bury it. Just leave it in the field. And with it, fill the belly of some hungry dog.
It was a good poem.
And I loved how stoked he was on it. He was like, I think I've gotten sharper than ever in my at the end of my life here as far as my poetry goes.
Yeah.
Delivers his final will and testament, which was a nice exclamation point at the end of Yabushige's character arc because he's been writing wills over and over this entire season. Torinaga also gives an explanation to Yabushige about why he's kept the Anjin alive when he had so many opportunities to let him die. He says, quote, not because he's important, but because he makes me laugh. And it's good to have something to distract our enemies.
Yeah.
And I was like, what? That's the most shallow reasoning ever for this entire case. Because this was more subversion because it's like you go into the show and you meet Blackthorn and you're like, there's our main character. Mm-hmm. And it's Whitey going to the Japans, right? And you're like, but then in the end, his character is almost completely inconsequential to this entire fucking thing. In a lot of ways. I mean, as far as character development goes, he's a great character. I'm not saying he's not.
He does end up being a pretty important cog in the whole plan.
Well, and largely as a distraction for his enemies.
It was
crazy. So there's so much usury from Torinaga that it makes it impossible to feel really great about him when it's all said and done.
Sure.
You're just like, wow.
Yeah.
Like, it reminds me of the Jack Nicholson line in The Departed where he says, a lot of people had to die for me to be me.
Yep.
And it's like, that's kingmaking. You got to, a lot of sacrifices have to be made for one person to grow that level of powerful.
Yep.
I brought up Fuji and Blackthorn doing the funeral in the water. That was a great scene. It was really cool. Also served as confirmation that a dream of a dream was not a reality, that Blackthorn did not return home to England and grow old and have two white grandchildren. And it also just was like, again, you told us this earlier in the season, but like Fuji was low-key great character development. Her and Blackthorn's relationship was like similar to Todomoriko's and Blackthorn's in the way, without the lust and the love, I think. Because she was kind of a big piece of teaching him, like, look, this is what it's all about here. This is what our culture is all about. And in helping Blackthorn kind of grasp this whole thing, which I think he did pretty much fully by the end of the season.
Yeah, totally.
So, yeah, instead of a big battle to close out the show, we get this flash forward to the battlefield where Ishido finds out that Lady Ochiba has double-crossed him and that the heir has not provided his troops, so Ishido has no banner and is now acting unlawfully. It's impossible, as an American television viewer, to not feel like you were had a little bit with all the buildup between Torinaga versus Ishido. And then there's no fight and no even full scene. You basically get 10-20 seconds of the battlefield with the huge armies and that's it. And that's it. And when it first happened and when the episode first ended, I was a little peeved.
Yeah.
I was like, God damn. And my first thought, and I still think this might be sort of the case, I was like, they must have had some serious budget constraints because the show seemed to kind of cut corners whenever it had the opportunity to keep from having to spend a ton of money on, like, war.
Well, okay. So I want to touch on a couple things that you said or respond to a couple things that you said. But let's start with that, because my wife, Laura, made a really good point, which was that when we think about shows that have a lot of battle scenes or battle sequences, and I'll just bring up the obvious one, Game of Thrones, House of the Dragon, etc. What do we typically like get from an episode with a battle? Not much else. And so in a way, it's like those episodes are used to prolong seasons or to give, like, they are giving us set pieces, but at the same time, they are filling an episode with story that doesn't need to push the plot forward a whole lot because it's mostly battle.
Very fair point.
And so it's like when they were conceiving the show and thinking about whether they wanted to do multiple seasons or one season. And I've not read the book, so I don't know how much the book Shogun focuses on big battles. I imagine that it doesn't much. But it's like by eschewing the big battle sequences, this makes more sense as a one season show. If you put in a bunch of big battle sequences, this makes more sense as a two or three season show.
For sure.
Because that's the type of story narrative arc that you would get from big battle sequences, is that you get a build up to a battle and then you get the come down from a battle. And that's like 1.5 to 2 episodes between those things. And then it's like, then you go back into the character and the plot and the character and the plot. But to go to the first thing you said, and you said as a TV viewer, and that's the first thing that came to mind for me as well, is that, like, and we've talked about this when we just kind of like cover the industry or talk about shows kind of at large, is that especially for you and I, but I think for a lot of audience members who watch a lot of this type of stuff, we do fall into the trap of watching stuff with TV brain.
And having these certain expectations.
And having expectations for certain beats and certain highs and certain things to happen. And you're absolutely right that we went into episode 10 being like, here we fucking go.
Battle.
It's battle time. It is battle time. And they totally did not give that to us. So in that way, it's like it's like when you pick up, you know, you think you're picking up your Sprite and you pick up your water instead, and you take a sip and you're like, oh, that's not Sprite. That's water. And it like is jarring and doesn't taste good to you,
later, you're like, water's still delicious.
Water's still good. Yeah. Yeah. I just wasn't expecting
it's just
the
not
water.
Sprite.
It's just not Sprite. And so I think that's, I wanted to come in today with the raw uncut. So I've not read, I've not listened, I've not done any studying up on the overall reaction to this episode.
Or if it was like followed the book.
Right, right.
Like, I really don't know the answer to that either.
And so I'm with you. I thought it was that it's hard not to have a little bit of sense of a letdown because it didn't deliver something that we were kind of expecting.
At least initially, yeah.
But at the same time, I love that they kind of like, I also like that and enjoyed the feeling of them totally not giving me what I thought I had coming.
Yep, I completely
like
agree.
That was pretty cool too, to be like, to just totally have me looking over here and then being like, nope, it's all over here.
Yeah, yeah. All right, final scene. Blackthorn is with Torunaga's men in Izu attempting to pull the Erasmus, his ship, out of the sea because I guess it just makes more sense to get that thing out and like build with that as the...
I think they're going to fix that one up.
Right.
Yeah.
They're going to get that one back to its former glory and then build other ships as well, making the fleet. Buntaro sets aside his personal beef with Blackthorn, being that his wife fell in love with him and may have pillowed with him. I guess yeah. Buntaro at this point, that was, again, in my American brain, I was like, how could he just, now his wife is dead, and he's like, well, I guess I'll be friends with the guy who screwed her 10 minutes before.
Yeah.
It was like, that was tough, but
because in death is life.
Yeah.
Ross, a flower is only a flower because it falls.
That's true, Barrett. But no, it was, again, this is like, there was so much subverting of expectations, and you expect, as Buntaro's walking up, you're like, oh, here we go, fight. But no.
Yeah.
They just bow to each other, and then he helps.
It was one more, I think I could see this type of scene playing out in a show about a Western culture, but it was one more piece of the pie for me on like what these people are all about, which is serving the greater good, essentially.
Yeah.
And contributing to the community as a whole.
Yeah.
So it's like with that, with the pressure point of Mariko not in the picture anymore, it's like, that gives Buntaro the opportunity to like set the sword down and move forward with his life. Yep. Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's a good thing that he does jump in there because the addition of Buntaro seems to get the ship out of the water.
That was enough. So now the ship weighs 700 tons, but this one tiny Japanese man was able to. It's funny because every time like Yabushige rips his clothes off to get in,
either a hot tub or
to go diving, you're like, wow, he's very small.
Yeah.
He's not like some jacked warrior, right?
No.
Which again is the difference in like Eastern and Western expectations. I'm like, I need Arnold Schwarzenegger under there, but it's.
No,
it's
all these guys, very
big yobs, who is quite little,
very very dainty, very frail. Not frail, but they're just slim, small dudes.
One more piece of business, and then we'll give our final thoughts. Are you looking for more confidence when it's time for pillowing? Good news, listener Sama. Today's episode is sponsored by Blue Chew, fellow aging samurai. Remember the days when you were always ready to go? Now you can increase your performance and get that extra confidence when it's time for some passionate pillowing. Listen up, BlueChew.com. Blue Chew is a unique online service that delivers the same active ingredients as Viagra, Cialis, and Levitra, but in chewable tablets and at a fraction of the cost. You can take them anytime, day or night, so you can plan ahead or be ready whenever an opportunity arises. The process is simple. Sign up at BlueChew.com, consult with one of their licensed medical providers, and once you're approved, you'll receive your prescription within days. The best part, it's all done online. No weird visits to the doctor's office, no awkward conversations, and no waiting in line at the pharmacy. Blue Chew's tablets are made in the USA and prepared and shipped direct to your door in discreet packaging. I've used Blue Chew's tablets several times and personally became harder than the rocks in Blackthorn's garden. If you're looking for more confidence, if you're looking to make a lasting impression, if you're in the market for the best pillowing session of your life, Blue Chew could be the answer for you, too. Blue Chew wants to help you have better sex. Discover your options at BlueChew.com. Chew it and do it. We've got a special deal for the Clam Fam. Try Blue Chew free when you use our promo code OCC at checkout. Just pay $5 in shipping. That's BlueChew.com, BlueChew.com. Promo code OCC to receive your first month free. Visit BlueChew.com today for more details and important safety information. And we thank Blue Chew for sponsoring the podcast. So, final scene. Blackthorn, they've gotten the Erasmus not quite out of the water, but enough so that he feels confident it won't sink back into the sea and he can pull it out all the way later, I guess. He looks out across the horizon and he sees Torunaga-sama standing majestically and they like nod at each other and that's it. And it's just like, Shogun. And that's the fucking end. And again, initial thoughts, I was like, what? How was that it? But the more I've sat with it, and this is only, you know, like
24 hours less.
Yeah, like yeah. 8, 10, 14 hours removed or something.
Yeah, yeah.
For me watching it, I loved it. I like that it was different. Yeah. I like that they didn't give me everything I wanted. I like that it, because it was still done in a really beautiful way. This was a lot more artsy than I expected when I started watching the show. I was fully geared up for a much more traditional Game of Thronesy Vikings fucking epic battle sequence type of show. And it turned out to not be that at all. Like, the more violent scenes we got came much earlier than I thought. Yep. And they were like, you know, his dipshit son blowing up people at cannon practice or whatever. So, like, oh, that was the other thing Yabushige requested. He was like, feed me to wild dogs.
Blow me up with a cannon.
Give me the piranhas or blow me to pieces with cannons. Which, not going to lie, I was like, yes, that one. That one's, let's do that again.
Yeah, let's get one more cannon practice.
But the show, it's not, it wasn't just subverting expectations for the sake of subverting expectations. It was making points, too, and largely about the differences between Western and Eastern culture and the differences in the way people look at things and just like that. That there's not one way of looking at the world, right? There's other ways of looking at the world and at life and death and everything that comes in between. And this kind of, it, in the same way, like Blackthorne's character arc serves as sort of an audience avatar in that by the end of the show, he gets it. Yes. He's bought in. He understands. He doesn't even care about England's religious battles anymore. He doesn't even want to take part. He doesn't even give a shit about the Portuguese. He just wants to be here and find his place, right? And it's not that, you know, obviously, as we've discovered over the course of today's podcast, there are still pieces of this thing that I don't understand. But on the whole, I walked away with an appreciation for this entire way of life, the whole samurai thing, the whole Japanese honor code of this feudal area of their history, like the way everything functioned. And that was really, really cool, man. I did not expect this to be as educational of an experience as it was.
When you illuminated the fact that the opening sequence is almost certainly a dream, that makes me feel even better about it. Because when you think about, like, you know, let's just picture what it would have looked like if this was, you know, 40 minutes of battle scene, then what you would have sacrificed for that is the kind of the character of Blackthorne coming full circle, right? Like, you wouldn't have gotten that him coming all the way around to being up on a hill, essentially, like, in the facing the loss of Mariko, willing to sacrifice himself for villagers that he doesn't know. You wouldn't have got him and him ready to build the fleet, ready to stay in Japan. I think that when Torinaga does deliver that line that he doesn't believe it's in the fate of the Anjin to ever leave this place, that's a line where I pause, around where I pause to see how much time we had left that really like made me go, okay.
There's not going to be a battle,
and it's also the one that was like, all right, this makes a lot of sense for what they're doing here, because they are spending this hour closing the loop on who these people are and who they became, rather than like giving us the explosives and the fireworks and the delivering us like the crazy, here's how Torinaga wins the battle, right? And so from that end, I really, really appreciated how they wrapped this thing up.
Yeah. Man, it was a lot. This was really well done, man. It was really well made TV. If I had to give it a grade at this point, B+, but like 89 out of 100.
I think for me, it's like sitting like low 90s, like A- type territory, with certainly the option for it to grow in my mind
over time
as I kind of digest it a little bit.
Yeah,
more.
Especially because it already has for both of us, it sounds like.
And I look, I'm always like after having done this with you for 8-ish years or so, it's like more and more every year, it's like I'm all about the journey. I'm all about like the middle episodes and how what are the highs that you can deliver when you are just like driving 100 miles an hour in the third, fourth, fifth episodes. And like, this show was hitting on all cylinders more than anything has in
a while, man. Yeah, that was, it was really impressive in that way.
And
it was humming.
It was humming. And I loved the setting. I loved the era that this took us to. I loved the character development. It did give us some of the spicier stuff earlier. I thought, I mean, it's just really, really well done and well acted. So despite the fact that there are some confusing things that maybe weren't knotted up super cleanly, overall, just really, really well done TV.
Yeah, and look, what do we always complain about? Not everything needs to be the same.
Yeah.
There's too much existing IP, which ironically this actually was, but there's too much, you know what I mean? There's too much of the Marvelization of Hollywood. Every show like this, you go into it with this expectation that it's going to be all these big battles, and then that's what it is. And like this, doing something different, which at the top of the show you said it was bold decision-making, and then it was executed well. That's where my appreciation for Shogun is at its highest, because it was great storytelling, it was great acting, it was a really cool setting, it looked good, they were very, very detailed in the way they executed this thing, and in the end, I thought the message was pretty clear-cut. It may not be what everybody wanted to hear, but that's okay.
Yeah.
That's okay. In fact, I would argue that's good, because too much of the same is what has really muddied and watered down Hollywood and both TV and film. So I really appreciate what they did here. And in the end, do I wish they'd stretched it to 2 seasons? Probably not.
Yeah,
because
probably,
it wouldn't be the same message.
Yeah.
It wouldn't hit
the
same way. And I think they certainly could have, and maybe it could have just been like, you know, back in the day, this would have been a 20-episode season or something.
Right.
But they did what they did, and they did it very, very well. I do expect that this will be nominated for stuff.
Definitely.
I do expect that FX will probably try to convince these showrunners to come back.
Maybe, yeah.
I don't expect them to say yes, based on the interviews I've seen with them where they've said, like, look, we would have had to have started that process a long fucking time ago. This took us forever to put this one thing together. We had the book. We covered the book. We did what we did, and we're done with it. So I'm pretty sure that we're good here. Torunaga's character ending up in a position where I can't judge whether or not he's good or evil or nefarious or somewhere in between. I really liked that too. Again, not normal. Not usually what you get out of a TV show like this with a guy who's presented as like, you're a good guy, you're supposed to be rooting for. And then by the end, you're like, but was he? And it's hard to say, but I do think that battle scene serves as confirmation that all these, his best laid plans ended with like less death and suffering longer term. And then he, you know, presumably becomes Shogun.
Very, very purposeful that the last frame is on him before cut to black, giant white letters.
Shogun. Yeah.
Yeah.
He's that guy. And I think that you have to buy into what he says to Yabushige that, you know, he's going to rule over like a warless Japan or whatever he says. Like this will be a big period of peace that's achieved as a result of all this. And when you put that into perspective with everything we saw this season, it feels a lot more worth it when I'm sitting here like, why Todomariko? No! Big Yabs, no! Hiromatsu, no! You know what I mean? They all died for a reason. That was great stuff, man. Really, really glad we didn't pick that other random HBO show to cover instead of this. No offense to that show. I'm sure it's fine. So what's next for us on OCC? Well, we're going to have a lot to talk about this week on Patreon to decide that. But certainly, Barrett and I both finished Three Body Problem, or you're on your way.
I'm halfway through Three Body Problem. Also, I started the third book. Another little Clam Fam correction. I had said that these characters in the season one are totally made up. They're just like new creations. Actually, not the case.
Oh.
So they are pulling from pieces of a lot of different characters. And so while there is still some amalgamation happening and they are all still kind of like serving a role that is in book one, there are characters in book three that you are introduced to for the first time that they are actually pulling from and inserting into the very first season. So,
oh wow,
a little interesting tidbit is that they very clearly like read all three books. They've got the whole thing and they crafted their story around people that pop in, from all three. So that's pretty interesting, pretty fascinating. So I'm looking forward to finishing the season and then covering it on the podcast.
So we'll definitely be doing a podcast about Three Body Problem. It will not be a podcast per episode of the show. It will be one podcast talking about the entire first season. We might do Fallout. I'm seeing a ridiculous amount of buzz around Baby Reindeer, which basically went viral over the weekend on Netflix and is like the number one Netflix show in the world right now. We'll almost certainly do a movie club as well, cover at least one movie in the time between now and when we will obviously be episodically covering season 2 of House of the Dragon starting June 16th, which is like a month and a half away, right? So we'll have a lot of content coming is the point. And of course, Barrett and I will be back tomorrow on patreon.com/oystersclamscockles, taking hotline calls from our supporters on Patreon to further digest and discuss Shogun. Really looking forward to hearing everybody's thoughts on this thing. Complicated as it was, I'm hoping we can maybe get some more clarity on some of the things we had questions about today as well from the old Mollusk Militia on Patreon. hit patreon.com/oystersclamscockles. Join, subscribe, support the podcast. There's a 7-day free trial right now, so it doesn't even cost you anything to come and check out what we've got going on Patreon. Tons of episodes from the last several years. Get in there so we can make sure we can keep doing what we're doing. That will do it for today's show. Thank you for being with us all season long and enjoying Shogun with us. We appreciate you, especially if you're new here. And thank you to all of our longtime listeners who joined us on this ride. Remember, we are available on all the major podcast platforms, but also in full video on youtube.com/@oystersclamscockles for your viewing pleasure. Subscribe on YouTube. Throw us a like if you're watching on YouTube right now. Subscribe, like, comment. Thank you. For more from me, Ross Bolin, check out the Ross Bolin podcast. If you're a Houston sports fan, check out my Houston sports podcast called Banging the Can. Mr. Dudley, where can people follow you and keep up with the other things you're doing?
I'm on X and on Instagram at Barrett Dudley, 2 R's, 2 T's.
I'm at WR Bolin on X, formerly known as Twitter and Instagram. Go to bolinmedia.com/shop to grab yourself some merch. Thanks for being here today. Thanks for listening. Thanks for watching. We look forward to hearing everyone's reactions on Patreon and reading them on social media. Until next time. Hi. Hi. Oh!